ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's Casterbris podcast with a K. Joining me, as usual, is, well, you know them, Christian and James. If you're our one listener, you're probably tired of our voices by now. If you're new listeners, you'll get tired of us. Don't you worry. And this week, we're going to be chatting about the infamous Robert Holmes. What specifically, chaps? What should we talk about? That's right. I'm an American guy, and I just said chaps.
Yeah, okay. We'll cut that bit out. our regular Casterbris podcast member, James McLean, doesn't feel that the legendary, great Robert Holmes, whose own hands have literally shaped Doctor Who from the 1970s, from the late 60s through most of the 1970s, and even managed to have immense influence with two single stories in the 1980s, isn't worthy of those plaudits. McLean, what have you got to say for yourself?
Power of Kroll. the space Win. Pirates, which actually isn't too bad, but it's still... The Crotons. I would even venture, and I know a lot of people would agree with me on this, I would even venture the Time Warrior as well. And maybe even... Mysterious Planet, or even perhaps a rather stodgy and meandering Two Doctors. My point was, as we were talking about this via email, as people do these days, because we no longer use voices in the future, we use a hyper transference of textual messages to each other through the mega zones.
It's mega zap, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is a serious bit of MZ there. We were just talking about the idea that so many fans, when they talk about Doctor Who, tend to fall into the same plaudits and the same pedestrian manners, and they just presume things. And one of the big things which gets me is that people go, Robert Holmes, you know, he was the golden era. He was the golden age of Doctor Who. And my point was not that Robert Holmes was crap. Far from it. I think Robert Holmes did some of the best Doctor Who's. He did, for instance, Talons of Wing Chang, which is one of my favourite Doctor Who's ever. Mm-hmm. Caves of Androzani, which I think is probably the pinnacle of Peter Davison's era. Spearhead from Space, which again was a fantastic start to one era, as Caves of Androzani was a fantastic end to one other. Ark in Space, again, which wasn't totally him, I believe, but it was still a very good story. So I'm not saying that he's terrible. I am just saying that I think he's an example of a writer who is remembered purely for what he's done, to the point that he's almost given like godlike status in Doctor Who. And the fact is that there's a good, you know, out of 10 stories, you could find a good 3 or 4 which are actually a bit below par. And I'm not talking about production. I'm talking about the story, because obviously there are episodes which aren't very good in production. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are actually bad in the actual story that they're telling.
Sure.
So that's to be clear as well. So this was my point, was just an example of someone who's, I never hear a bad word said about. And yet at the same time, I think if we were fans, we would have to be quite honest and say, for all the wonder and gushing you can put at Robert Holmes, there are occasions where I don't think he was quite the wonder, and I don't know whether that's fair or not. So I thought I would bring it up here. With
all right, so it's a good subject. Let's bring it into context. Russell T. Davies once said, I'll try not to do the accent, take the talents of Wang Chang, for example. Watch episode 1. It's the best dialogue ever written. It's up there with Dennis Potter by a man called Robert Holmes. When the history of television drama comes to be written, Robert Holmes won't be remembered at all because he only wrote genre stuff. And that, I reckon, is a real tragedy. Apologies to our Welsh listener.
Eve Miles. You'll now be storming out of the room after your terrible impersonation of her.
But, you know, Davies has got a point. If anyone knows about writing dialogue in modern times, it's Russell T. Davies. He's a man who can tell you everything about a single individual with, like, 5 words of dialogue from that person's mouth. So he knows what he's talking about here. He's also mentioned that the Ark in Space is his favourite story from the original Doctor Who series, which is fair enough, because as you intimated, that's one of those. It's an amazing collision of ideas, a good script, amazing set design, and obviously the acting. But, you know, if Robert Holmes has got stories that aren't that good, and he's bound to with, what, 18 or so Doctor Who stories, are his worst ones still better than the best ones of other writers?
Yeah, I think some of his worst ones are worse than some of the best ones of other writers. I don't think... I think sometimes he does suffer a little from... there's a couple of repetition of ideas, and he is very much a man of the AB to a certain degree. Actually, no, that's not probably quite fair, but I think the weaker stories are the ones where he falls into a little bit of the Doctor Who formula, where they sit between points A and point B. Power Patrol is an excellent example of this. Mysterious Planet is another excellent example of this, where you've basically got two set points, and it's just the protagonist going from those two set points in different orders. And there's a couple of... I think that's where he sometimes gets a little formulaic. I don't think... As a character writer, I don't think he was actually a fantastic character writer. I think he was a fantastic... theatrical writer. I think where his characters stood out was not because they felt real, not because they felt genuine, but he did put more effort into characters in Doctor Who than I think a lot of writers did. And they often meant that they were more larger than life. An obvious example is the brilliant Rebos operation.
Yeah.
Where you have Umstoff and
Garen.
Yes, who are wonderful characters. Not really believable. They're full of cliches and are pastiches of two different sort of archetypes, but they really make the story. So I wouldn't say he's a great character writer, but he does seem aware that to make a good story, you've got to have interesting characters in there. So that is, I think, one of his strengths. And as I didn't want this to be a critique of where I think Doctor Who is crap, Robert Holmes is crap.
No, sure.
I just wanted it to be a more honest appraisal of what people consider to be a godlike influence on Doctor Who.
Okay, I'm gonna be a couple of minutes with this, so bear with me.
Yeah.
Let's take, say, Spearhead from Space through to the Ribos operation as, and I know, you know, there's Time Warrior in there, and Sunmakers. Let's take that as a kind of core of the best Robert Holmes, okay? We've obviously got the Case of Andrew Zani. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, we then get to Mysterious Planet and Ultimate Foe territory and the whole Trial of a Time Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Mysterious Planet, on paper, should be quite good. Now, is that one that fails because of the direction, casting, whatever? Or is it actually not that good? Or is it something that's just been completely lost in the mix of the Trial of a Time Lord?
Very good questions.
Brian? Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, wow. Mysterious Planet. I thought that story kind of had potential, but unfortunately, and you know, I wonder if part of it isn't kind of suffering a little bit from 80s TV, and that may seem unfair, but one thing I've noticed a lot about 80s TV is...
Sorry?
80s TV?
Oh, 80s TV, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. It's just the bright colors, the bright lights, the actors, everything kind of was all hammy. Everything was very, I don't know, it's so hard for me to describe, but it's not really like the best, certainly for me, it's not the best era of Doctor Who. And that isn't to put down any of the actors in the show or any of the stories, because there were some gems in there. And I do really like Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy and Peter Davison. But something about their eras, just they lost that kind of feel that certainly at least the 70s Doctor Who had. And I can't pinpoint what it is, but certainly a lot of times the stories, the way they're written, just don't fly for me. And I think Mysterious Planet, while, like you said, it looked good on paper, I really don't think that it actually did pull it off on screen. And I don't know if that was just because of shoehorning in the trial aspect of that season, because it did seem like a lot of those stories suffered from the fact they weren't allowed to stand on their own feet.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's where I kind of feel most of the issues were with that. You couldn't watch the story properly unfold because you kept being interrupted.
I don't know. I would say with Mysterious Planet, it's one of the few examples where I think the trial actually made it a little more interesting, because I think it was a very drab affair. I think the only thing that was really going for it was the first time we actually saw Colin being able to relax and not have to play this aggressive Time Lord, and he was lot smoother. His relationship with Perry with Pelly and Perry was a lot more pleasant and a lot less abrasive.
We should do that in the next Doctor Who cartoon strip that we do in Custerbers. Doctor Who in the 1970 World Cup with Pelé.
Yeah, good old Pelé. I did love his tits. that'll be out. I think one interesting example on Mysterious Planet is where it fails, and where I was talking about the repetition of the ideas, is Sabalon Glitz, again feels like a pastiche of what had already been done in the in the Rebos operation.
Yeah.
I don't think, as much as I actually quite like Glitz in some respects, it did feel like nothing new there, and it did feel
You do get similar dialogue as well, don't you?
Yeah, it didn't feel like a very, but it's again in favor of him, it's another example of Robert Holmes trying to put interesting characters into Lift, a pedestrian, perhaps a little pedestrian story, which I think it is. I think there's a twist at the end which is fairly predictable. Ravelox, the creature in it isn't particularly scary. There's nothing that really stands out there that hadn't been done. You've got the power of Kroll like nomadic element to it.
Yeah.
It is one of his weaker stories. I think I can't doubt that, regardless of the production. I don't think it was a good submission. Synopsis might have been good, but when it was put over the length of time, I don't think it holds up well.
Before we get to the Two Doctors, which I think has committed some similar crimes, and you know, I think there are reasons for it beyond the writer. I do think we do have director issues in the 80s.
Yeah.
Just in terms of the Mysterious Planet, am I right in thinking the Trial of a Time Lord series was script edited by John Nathan Turner?
I am not sure.
Because I think by this time, they'd fallen out, hadn't they, him and Soward. And for some reason, I do think that at least some of it was script edited by Nathan Turner, which might explain why Mysterious Planet didn't turn out too well. I don't know. Let's go to the Two Doctors.
Well, I Two Doctors doesn't really work for me. I find the antagonists aren't particularly strong. I find the Centaurans, again, I don't know, maybe the Centaurans aren't a particular, because they're a race of clones, they don't really have that much potential as individual characters to be anything particularly interesting. Obviously what holds it together is this excitement of having Troughton and Baker and of course Fraser Hines involved in it, and that sort of lifts it. But again, even though you've got two parts to it, and obviously the second part in Seville is far more interesting than the parts on the space station, it does again fall into the A-B situation a little. You know, getting into the house, getting out the house, getting into the house, getting out the house.
But this is one of those weaknesses of that era of Doctor Who, isn't it?
To a degree, yes, I'd agree with you. I mean, if you were to extend this argument about stuff that we don't really appreciate in Doctor Who, I think a wonderful example is the Time Monster, where you have a story which mimics a lot of what was going on in the 60s Doctor Who, where they're overambitious, they don't have the budget, but they try and move the story along through to different points, so the story doesn't keep going back on itself.
Yeah.
And people never really look at the Time Monster with much appreciation, apart from Delgado. But it is it's a nice attempt to try and break away from formula. And I agree with you, in the 80s, there seemed to be very little attempt to do that anymore. It did seem to be very much a point A to point B approach. Yeah.
I think the other problem with the Two Doctors is, and I like the Two Doctors, and I like the whole, I like the influence of the Time Lords in there, and I like Shazini and all the Androgum stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with the Sontarans. There could really have been any one, and I think if they hadn't already been antagonistic towards the Time Lords previously, I think it could have been anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 6 episodes long in Old Money, basically, isn't it? It's 3 45 minute episodes.
Yeah,
and all that business with the acting waiter and the waitress and all that. I mean, if it was me, that would have been gone. You know, it would have been a four-part. If it had been up to me, it would have been a four-part, and all that nonsense would have been gone.
Mm. I agree with that. That was definitely its failing for me. It was just too long. I enjoyed the main body of the story. I didn't mind the Centaurans. I did like the main theme of, the time experiment, as well as the genetic experiments. I liked all that stuff, and I even liked all the needs for having the doctor there and so on. I just thought it was well done in that respect, but it was too, and I don't know if you want to call it padding, but whatever they tried to fill that in for, why they tried to stretch it for so long just didn't work. It didn't, yeah. It wasn't necessary.
Yeah. It is very pedestrian in its pacing as well. I don't mind the bit where the second doctor and the chap with the funny name, Shock Eye of the Quans and Grig, go off for a meal, but I think it goes on a bit too long. Now, that the two doctors was directed by Peter Moffat, whose other works could be also considered to be a bit on the pedestrian side. State of Decay, Visitation, Mordred Undead, Twin Dilemma. The Five Doctors does have its low points, but I think he manages to keep it up with that. You know, that's only my opinion. Perhaps those are some of the most exciting episodes of Doctor Who ever.
But I mean, it is to a certain degree tied a little with Robert Holmes. I mean, I'm not wanting to blame or blame him too much. But I mean, if you look at the Time Warrior, pacing in that is very, I would say, a bit stodgy. And I would say, interestingly, because not a lot of people agree with me, I would say that's one of his worst ones. I find that the medieval characterizations is stodgy and childish. Yes, to a certain degree, Lynx lifts it a little bit, but by and large there's not much really going there, which is very interesting or hasn't been done before. And again, you see little bits of what makes the Rebos operation good in the Time Warrior not being so good, those sort of archaic medieval characterizations, for example. So
transposing them to an alien planet works.
Yeah, I think it gave it a little character. I mean, I'd like to say in his favour, I think perhaps what failed with the Time Warrior, he redid in a sort of way with the Rebos operation and made it work. But I do feel there's a bit of a pedestrianism sometimes in his pacing, which makes it easy to watch the first time. But I don't ever, a lot of his, I don't ever feel this real need to go and rewatch the Two Doctors, Time Warrior.
Okay. Is there, therefore, given what we've already heard, is there an element of Robert Holmes in Russell T Davies' work? If we take the Time Warrior and we break it down to the fact that there's a new companion, there's a new alien monster, and it's set in the past.
Hold on, we've got
a checklist of three items there. Is that something that Russell T Davies would have done with a script? Would he have just taken like three items, then flushed it out with dialogue? And maybe ended up with a slightly empty idea?
I'm trying to like run through all of his scripts and see if I feel that anywhere. Because there were elements sometimes where I just felt he not necessarily just had three items and then just worked around those items, but I felt that he kind of had an idea that rather than seeing the fault in it, just stuck with it because that was the idea that was in his head. Like, for instance, the Sluthene. You know, finding an alien that you know, just farts a lot to be amusing on screen, and then still rolling with it and not realizing that this may be just a tad too childish for this show right now. He rolled with it, you know, but I don't know if that's necessarily something that we can blame Robert Holmes of doing.
No, sure.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think you could probably, I would agree. I think there's a logic in that. I think they're very different writers, as you said at the beginning.
Sure.
But I think perhaps how they approach stories is probably quite, not necessarily clinical, but it with ingredients.
Yeah.
Like you say, and those ingredients to put it together. And I think on the by and large, that is a way that works. And as you say, I think the parallel with Russell T Davies with Holmes is that when he's good, he's very good. When he's bad, I don't think Davies is really bad, as some people think. But I think there are times where he's bland, where it feels a bit pedestrian. What was that? New Earth?
Yes.
Well, you know, New Earth didn't bother me like it bothered you. I thought it was, I agree. I would say it was like it was a perfect example of the Time Warrior for me. I mean, I know you found some of the characterizations and the mind swapping irritating, but if you take away from that, the actual story itself and the dialogue, it wasn't bad. It just wasn't anything particularly good either. And David Tennant just looked bored through it, really, apart from his attempts to pretend to be Rose.
My issue with New Earth wasn't so much the body swapping or any of that stuff. You know, it was what it was in the story. My issue was Russell trying to take the reins back of his own show from Stephen Moffat, in a way, if you want to look at it that way. He tried to have an empty child, or rather the Dr. Dance's moment. He tried to take it back and say, hey, I can do that too, is how it presented itself on screen. Whether or not that's what he was actually trying to do, I don't know. But when the doctor goes down the elevator shaft and he cures everyone and he has that moment, I am the doctor and I healed everyone, it was like he was trying to relive the just this once everybody lives moment from the Dr. Dances. And that just, to me, it failed. It didn't seem right. It didn't feel right. It didn't play right. But the rest of the episode I was fine with. I liked the premise behind it. It seemed like the main goal in it was these cat nuns, how, for whatever purpose they were using these humans, were had their own goals, and Cassandra just wanted to get rich off of that. It seemed right. She wanted to bring herself back in the proper standing. I didn't have a problem with how that played out. It was just the end, and that was a sad thing. When you go through a story that's otherwise okay, and then you hit the end and it just fails to live up to what it should have done, it just makes the whole story kind of feel off. And perhaps maybe that's what's going on with you, Christian, or maybe those other things were just too bad for you to even get past. But that's what I find a lot of times.
I think probably he always strikes me as quite an analytical. I mean, I've always said this. I think he's a very good producer, while I think Moffat is a better writer than producer. I think Davis is probably a better producer than writer, in the sense that he's got a very good idea of scope. And how to pace, and how, well, then you have to argue probably The Last Torchwood is an example against this. But generally speaking, I'd have thought the reason New Earth was like that was, from his mind, he seems to be very wary of trends and how to treat, not just how to treat the younger audience, but very wary as a new show, how the younger audience was feeling. And I would imagine New Earth was possibly a little too much of an artificial attempt after, for kids, a very dark moment where their doctor died and was replaced by a new guy, to try and show that the show was fun and it was exciting, and not to be worried that Chris is no longer there. This new guy is a lot of fun, and look at these crazy little antics. And it was a little too artificial, but I reckon that was his intent. There was to try and lift it for those new audiences who would still be a little shell-shocked that their brand new exciting hero was now this new guy who they weren't sure about, and this was the first time they had to cope with that. And I think he went a little too far in that approach, maybe, and it just felt a little too sugary, and a little too simple, and a little too pedestrian, maybe, as well. But that, I think, comes possibly from less of him being a bad writer. I know no one's suggesting that, but probably more of him making a bad call as series producer.
Okay. Yeah, I'll agree with that.
All right, so back to Robert Holmes, as that is why we're here this week.
Mm-hmm. I had a point if about the two doctors, actually, just skipping back to that.
Yeah.
Do you think the story maybe suffered a bit less from Robert Holmes and a bit more from the typical issues that happened under JNT with the location shooting? I mean, they were going to Spain, right? That was Spain, yeah. And do you think that it was kind of like Robert Holmes may have had this pretty good story for the two doctors, and then they were like, well, hey, it's in Spain, we want to have more time, spread it out. And you know, that's what killed it, you know, trying to spread this this two-part story over three parts for no reason whatsoever.
It's entirely plausible to me.
I mean, it makes sense, but I don't understand the production. I don't know if it was always, hey, we're going to Spain, we need a three-part story, Bob, roll with it. Or if it was, hey, write this story. Oh, look, we can go to Spain. I know you've already written it. Shoehorn more stuff into it. You know, because I don't know if I would necessarily blame him, because I think they did that to us once before when they went to Lanzarote
for Planet Fire.
Yeah. I mean, they just improperly used it. And as a matter of fact, can Doctor Who be accused of that? You know, now I'm going to get off Robert Holmes, but can Doctor Who be accused of that? You know, they go to Lanzarote, they go to Spain, and they go to Dubai. Did they use those locations to the best of their abilities? You know, Dubai, I guess, you know, the story, a lot of people don't think it was necessarily a great story, but the setting at least worked.
Tune in next time, ladies and gentlemen, when we'll be discussing this matter in depth.
Well, I'm just looking at Wikipedia at the moment, and it says, and again, take with a pinch of salt, Holmes' original brief from John Nathan Turner was to write a serial taking place in New Orleans involving the Suntarans, Second Doctor and Jamie. So obviously it was like Russell T. Davis. He was briefed to write it abroad. But the setting had to be changed in Spain when the expected funding for location filming in the United States fell through. Holmes was particularly disappointed that much of the humour involving the differences between America and Britain was lost in the rewrite. The only hint we get of this humour is in episode one, where the Sixth Doctor looks at Perry and says that Columbus has a lot to answer for. So we could see where Robert Holmes' humour was going to end up.
Yes.
Sounds a bit like, let's see how many comments we can make to bash America. I'm only joking. Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't like that.
But you know what, though? That actually does, to me, explain a lot as to why the story didn't quite hold up. I mean, if he had this passion to write this story for New Orleans and to have those kind of differences be in there, it sounds like that would have provided fun throughout. And then when you change the location, you know, who knows if it was a hasty rewrite or if he just didn't have the same passion or the same flair for writing for Spain. And, you know, like it sounds like it could have been quite an entertaining and humorous story. Or no, let me change that. I was just talking about this the other day. One of my favorite things, and Doctor Who does it well, certainly new Doctor Who, but the old one always did, is tell a serious story with lots of good comedy in it. You know, so they let you have fun at the same time they try to scare you. And I love when a story can do that rather than just do an all out comedy. And it seems like Robert Holmes was good at that, because certainly if you look at the Talons of Wang Chiang, Jago and Lightfoot were great comic relief.
But they weren't joke characters, were they? And that concerns
me. No, they weren't functional comic relief, were they? They were just very well-written characters and well-played.
He never strikes me as a humorous writer, which is why I'm a little worried by the idea that he had a sort of like a fondue of gags, but ready,
no,
primed.
That's good, though.
Fondue of gags?
You know, this idea of the differences between America and Britain, and that, I mean, the comic, the one that they pointed at with Colin Baker saying to Perry, it irritates me. I don't find that particularly funny at all. It seems a very lazy joke to make, especially probably because the Sixth Doctor was making them constantly, Perry.
Yeah.
It sort of loses its barb, doesn't it, when it's just
it
like,
does a bit, yeah.
Oh, just another attack at the kid.
And the other difficult thing there, too, is the Sixth Doctor at that point in his life was still being that blustery kind of mean character to everyone. So, it, you know, having those kind of jokes said by him perhaps may not have been the best.
But it's hard to say because we don't know exactly what the gags were going to be. So it might have been something entirely different. But I kind of think that where he works best, as you say, with comedy is in the comic relief characters, I think, as you put so brilliantly, is where he works, whether it's Talons of Wing Chiang, the Rebos operation. I'm trying to think of other ones. He doesn't have that many, actually, thinking about it.
But the reason that they work, though, is because, like you said earlier, he fleshes out characters. He makes real...
Well, you've got the Master as well, haven't you?
Funny.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the Master is hilarious.
Especially in Terror of the Autons, he's got some
exactly.
lovely lines.
Yeah,
in the
brilliant. Yeah.
Which is brilliant. But I think his stronger stuff is when generally where he plays it straight. I think the Rebos operation is a great feel-good episode to watch. It might not be the best episode of Doctor Who in itself. There's a lot, as I say, there's a lot of hammy characters. In the actual production itself, there's some dodgy acting, and K-9 is obviously in there to make things feel like it's written for a four-year-old. But you know, if you look at, say, Spearhead from Space is a great example of just really good, solid science fiction writing, which doesn't really hang upon comedy characters. There's that great rural character I know at the beginning who steals one of the orbs, the spheres, and hides in his garden. He's a great, great character in there, but he's not a comedy.
Sam Seeley?
Yes, Sam Seeley. He's great. I love him. But it's quite a very serious tone to that story. And Terror of the Autons as well is a pretty dark, serious one. Pyramids,
it's a bit more
of
cartoony, yeah. Though. There's, I mean, it's more of a cartoony sort of retread of Spearhead from Space, isn't it?
Yes. It is still quite a dark one, though, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes, yes.
Several dark. I know what you mean, though. Spearhead from Space feels almost cinematic.
Yeah, yeah.
Feels like it could be in the Quatermass era.
Yeah.
It's got that feel to it. Ark in Space, which I know was based on the story outline of
John Lucarotti.
John Lucarotti, yeah, but the actual tone and the way it's been written was played very seriously. Periods of Mars, even though Tom Baker's given a lot of leeway to have a bit of fun in there, he does, even Tom really holds the serious nature of that, and you feel, you know, the it's a very dark Brain of Morbius again. Deadly Assassin, okay, you've got the two comedy Time Lords at the beginning in part one who lose their robes. But generally speaking, it's his serious nature which makes his stories, I think, because he takes the stories quite seriously.
Yeah.
You know, the 70s. The Deadly Assassin, as much as I say that, like, generally that whole era kind of, you know, killed the Time Lords for me, because I never, like I said last time, I just didn't feel that they were ever as cool as they were in the War Games. I have to admit that I actually liked those two comedy Time Lords when they did lose the robe. I thought that was a really funny moment for some reason, and it just worked. And I, you know, I hadn't put it together that it was Bob Holmes, you know, that just made that work that way. But for some reason, it was funny to me.
It's a shame, isn't it? Because in a way, a show should be able to explore different avenues of characters without having to get fixed on them. It's a shame that the Deadly Assassin couldn't have been a one-off political satire of the Gallifrey, but when you went back to Gallifrey again, it could have been just like the War Games again. There's no in the same way that you can have you can make political satire of the Happiness Patrol, but the next time you go to another alien out colony, it doesn't have to be like the Happiness Patrol. There was no reason it had to stick into that vein of becoming very much about England austerity in English culture, which it did, to the point, as you say so well, Christian, just becomes like this very cardboard IKEA with stodgy characters. So Holmes isn't really to blame for the loss of the Time Lords.
No, one very smart
episode which satired bureaucracy. There was no reason it had to carry on down that vein. That's the production getting very
lazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they were parodying doing an homage to a movie, weren't they? Which movie was that? With that story.
Deadly Assassin's Manchurian Candidate, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
And, you know, there's lots of politics in Manchurian Candidate, but they're both more... Well, I mean, you wouldn't... Just because you'd made the Manchurian Candidate, you wouldn't make it again, would you?
No, exactly.
In exactly the same way, so, yeah.
No, but, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, like, we kind of...
I mean, even if you compare the two main versions of the Manchurian Candidate, the two big movie versions, the 60s version and the 2000s version, they're completely different. They're essentially the same film. So it's telling the same story, but done in completely different ways.
It is just frustrating that it ended up being like an established fact that they were this very dull, stodgy race, which is why the Doctor left them, because they were just so boring. And the fact that they're wielding this all gigantic power seemed to be forgotten, and that gigantic power does not lead to people being... Well, I suppose it can do, but it doesn't make for interesting television.
No.
And I think it was a shame, because it also left the Doctor losing a lot of his alien identity after that, because you've now seen that he came from consistently this very pedestrian background of boring people, rather than him being a race of very powerful alien creatures, which
I've seen
wanted,
in the War Games.
Yes, that he wanted to escape from and experience almost being human, you could argue.
Yeah,
they never really explored the power that they had held in the War Games again, and that's something that they really should have done. And I suppose maybe Russell got there a little bit with Rassilon at the end of time, but you know, I think somebody can bring them back and somebody can make them scary again. And, you know, they don't have to be the villains. I think it was kind of a mistake, personally, to bring them back and make them be the villains or make them want to end the universe or anything like that. But I think that you can bring them back and make them mess with the Doctor's life in a way that it's kind of like some of the times that they were best used, obviously in the War Games, and then episodes like Genesis of the Daleks.
Yeah.
What was another Pertwee one where they sent him, they basically told him, hey, you're working for us, go do it. Like the mutants, they just basically sent him without even talking to him, you're doing this. And he went and he did it. And it was kind of like, you know, well, you've called me, you know where I'm at now, I have to do these things for you, rather than, you know, be the rebel that the Doctor usually is. You know, he kind of had some fear in him from them. And that was good. And even in, what was it, Terror of the Autons, when that one Time Lord shows up, you know, in a bowler cap and so on, you know. And I admit, I like that moment, but it showed a lot that the Doctor knew he had to listen to this guy. But what I liked about it was I still had in my head at that time the War Games Time Lords, and that they were trying to, you know, let's talk to the Doctor in his own ways. And that's what kind of made it funny for me in a way, that, you know, like these completely powerful and oppressing, I don't know, kind of feeling beings were that kind of comical with him in that one moment. But then it goes too far later on in the series. But I think someone can bring them back, and I think someone can make them be as cool as they were and kind of undo what had been done in the past.
It's kind of a shame that sort of Big Finish and the books as well have sort of perpetuated the same sort of Gallifrey that you sort of see in the 80s
right.
to a lot of degree, and there's not been an attempt to give them back their status to something where they're just sort of laughed at by the Doctor, really, and you don't really feel their power. And I suppose you could argue that's fair enough. You know, races and civilizations go through periods of austerity and through impotence, and you can have a once a great powerful nation that becomes a sort of almost a mockery of tourism to itself. But I think End of Time was good in the sense that It showed a race that lost its way, wasn't it? It wasn't saying that they were evil, that they had just lost their way, and at least that gave them back a bit of their power and made them someone to be worried about. So I'll give it credit for them there, yeah. But I still think they if they do come back again, I agree. Maybe going back away from the Robert Holmes onward era, and which actually, as we said the other week, is more Three Doctors than Robert Holmes, because they started to lose it in the Three Doctors, didn't they, with their little computer tie room and their them needing to be rescued by the Doctor. Suddenly they've been castrated quite significantly.
Okay, let's wind it back to Robert Holmes. You know, we've gone through a lot of critical appreciation, and that's a very nice way of putting it, of Robert Holmes's Doctor Who output. Now, obviously, James' contention is that Robert Holmes is a very good writer, but not the great almighty writer that he is portrayed as being. So first of all, who, let's each of us pick a Robert Holmes character that we love and one that we find completely and utterly pointless. I'll let James go first.
Oh, that's not fair. You should go first. You came with the question, so you must have ideas.
Hey, you guys both dumped the last one on me.
Well, the topic was your idea, so you're going first.
So I'm going first. So you want one character which epitomises his brilliance, and one that perhaps epitomises his weakness.
Yes.
Okay, that's a very tall order. I think you've made there. That epitomises his greatness. Well, if I was to epitomise his greatness in character writing, I think I'd have to be very dull, and my first gut reaction would be to go with the Talons of Wing Chiang. I think Lightfoot and Jago, while again, like most of his characters, are pastiche of stereotypes, I don't know whether you argue it's their writing or whether it was the actors, but there was some chemistry there which made them two of the most wonderful portrayals of secondary characters in the show, which I'm so glad they've had their Big Finish run.
Yeah.
So I would say them. There's if I was going for serious characters, I would possibly say that's a difficult one, because as with all these things, it's hard to differentiate between what's good on paper and what's brought to life by actors, which always makes it a little tough. But I think The Caves of Androzani had some very smart writing with what was the name of the guy on Androzani, Major?
Morgus.
I think Morgus was a very bold bit of writing, with some fourth wall breaking off with a soliloquy, sort of an inner monologue. I thought that was a very brave, and I respect him a lot for that. I think the weakest bits for me probably end up in The Time Warrior. I think virtually every character in that was just a vapid pastiche, which had no life to it, that I think all the actors struggled with, because there was very little there to recommend them apart from Lynx. So I would say all of them, including Dot from EastEnders.
Okay, I'm going to go next. So give Brian a couple of moments. I'm just going to stick with what I'd suggested. So, like, a good character and a bad character.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. No, it's just I don't have your imagination. And I kind of already had an inkling of what I was going to say to start with.
I knew you did.
Oh. Yes. So my worst character, I think, you know, there are a lot of contenders in the Mysterious Planet. but I think it's going to have to be Joan Sims Katrika.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're looking at the writing, it was kind of sub Iron Gron.
Mm-hmm.
And the performance was sub Carry On. See what
yeah.
I did there?
Yes, very good.
So I think, yeah, it's got to be John Sim there. Best character, I think, just going back to what you said, it has to be Morgus. Absolutely fantastic from John Normington.
Yes.
Performance, making it, taking what's on the paper and, you know, sprinting with it, you know, building something amazing out of it, something memorable.
Yeah.
That's chilling and slightly amusing in a very dark and
yes.
uncomfortable way.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Brian?
If I have to go with worst, I'm actually going to have to pick from the two doctors and say, I guess his name is Oscar, because I really just kind of felt that, like we had just said in the podcast, it was a waste. It wasn't a necessary element. And I didn't really like, you know, and maybe this is down to the actor, but I didn't really like the characterization. I didn't really feel for the character. And I thought, like, it was very over the top. It was just somebody I could have easily lived without.
Yeah.
But for a best, and I'm struggling a tad here because I'm just trying to make sure that I'm correct in saying this, but he was the first to ever write for Mike Yates, wasn't he? Terror of the Autons was Mike Yates' first story, if I'm not mistaken.
Was what?
Mike Yates' first story.
Was he in Terror of the Autons? If he was, then yes.
Yeah, I believe that was his first one, because I actually would like to credit him there for that, because I felt Mike was a very strong character, and whether or not he had a big hand in where he was actually going, I really liked the development of him all the way down to, you know, if we say he's a companion, you know, he was one of the first to get turned and make this complete change. Instead of being made better by the Doctor, he actually got made worse in the end, and eventually came around to make the situation better in a way. But mm-hmm. I liked that. I liked seeing this development of that character go. So I would kind of credit him with that one if I was allowed.
Okay, yeah, I think we can let you.
Yeah, well, I suppose.
That's quite over there, you.
Yes, I'm not quite happy about that. I'm just looking. Mike Yates was indeed in Terror of the Autons. Just trying to see if it was his first appearance. First appearance it was. Yes, it was. Terror of the Autons. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Nice one.
And what makes you unhappy about that one, Mr. James?
I don't. I think it's... well, it's because, I suppose, because it's a character which you are taking what happened to him later, which doesn't necessarily relate to how he was in the story that was written for him by Robert Holmes.
Well, the reason I started there, though, is because I thought he was an instantly likable character. Like, when he's written in Terror of the Autons, you know he's not just a one-off story character. And I don't know why that is, but when I first saw that story, and I don't think I had seen Mike Yates. No, I may have seen him. I did. I saw him in Planet of the Spiders first, but I had no clue it was the same character. Because I saw them completely out of order, but when I saw Terror of the Autons, I didn't know it was him. I had absolutely no idea what was actually going on, but when I saw him in Terror of the Autons, it was just very clear he was going to be a new, proper character. And I don't know, I liked his usage. I liked his character in that story. That's, I mean, you could even argue the Master as well if you wanted, you know, but I don't know, I thought Mike worked very well.
Okay, well,
I think it's a good one. Could I just also say Marcus Garman's worth mentioning, because that was a very bold move to produce such a sympathetic character and then kill him off so very coldly.
Yeah,
was Mark a good writer? Yeah, exactly. But I just, one of my final points, I've just noticed when we've been talking about this, what I think my issue with Robert to a certain degree is that there's a lot of repetition and a lot of pastiches which come up. And as we've been talking, he's seen a lot of those nodes within the stories that do resurface over and over again. As you say, Iron Gron and Carry On.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I mean, that's a fascinating discussion we've had. You know, no one is saying that Robert Holmes is a bad writer.
No, not at all.
We're just kind of balancing the playing field out, levelling the playing field, and just say he's a very good writer, but he's got some weak points.
Absolutely.
But if we just think for a moment, he's probably the most influential writer in Doctor Who's original series. If he's not the most, he's certainly among them, along with people like Terence Dix and Barry Letts, in terms of shaping how we perceive Doctor Who. Just to give you an example, Terror of the Autons was set in a fictional town called Tarminster, which, as well as appearing in a hospital in the Sarah Jane Adventures, was also the town mentioned on the Harold Saxon promotional website, which stated that Lucy Saxon's father was Lord Cole of Tarminster. So it, you know, all the way up to 2008, his influence is there, and we'll be feeling it.
So you're saying that his influence on the writers, and especially in the new series, he's still felt.
Absolutely right.
That's a fair point. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wasn't there a new series episode as well that we all kind of felt they took a page from Robert Holmes by creating those two comical characters? Like a team of characters. I forget which one it was now, but there was something that we all kind of felt like, wow, that they really, and you know, now this is going to seem pointless because I can't remember the episode.
Yeah.
So someone just edit me out of there.
Well, are we not talking about the Silurian Victorian detective and her young maid?
I
see where you're going with that as well. There's a similarity there.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I have to say, since I started all this, again, that Talons of Wing Chiang is probably one of my top five Doctor Who's, and the Rebos Operation is probably in the top 10, maybe. Mm. So there's no doubt. And Spirit from Space as well, and Caves of Androzani. So it's no doubt that it's not an attack on him as a writer.
What was up with Pyramids of Mars, though? Why did I see that was written under a different name?
I think it was one of those ones which was started off by someone else and wasn't quite up to scratch, so it was rewritten.
I see. So he gets credited with it.
Yeah. Slight difference to Talons of Wang Chang, which was a complete. It basically took like two elements from the original story. The Foe from the Future, which was by Robert Banks Stewart and is now, or shortly available through Big Finish. It only has like two elements that they're in common, and then Robert Holmes, sure, like just took those and wrote a completely new story. So that's the difference, basically. And I think that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K. And as you listen to this, we're all sunning ourselves on a beach on the outer worlds, thanks to Brian's TARDIS. But we'll be back in the UK next week for some fresh Casterbus podcasts. Not that this one wasn't fresh, but fresher. Until next time, bye-bye.
Holmes.
Mm. Very good.
Yes. Yeah, all right.
You don't have to do a British accent. Just use your own voice.
Well, that's fine. Whatever. Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Then welcome to good evening. It's not the evening.
I'm going to say you're jumping to some conclusions there, aren't you?
I know you're listening to us in bed right now, dear listener, and I'm happy to join you.
Let's start with that.